From Studio J, 10 stories above K Street, this is the Education Gadfly Show.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, calling from lovely New Mexico, joining my effervescent co-host, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, now you sound good, babe. You sound right. Like you're right here with us.
How you doing, Rick?
I'm doing good. I was tired. I was out at that Milken Global Conference. Woof. A lot of smart people in good suits.
Yeah, well, hey. And you're right up there with them, Rick. You've got some nice suits, too, and you're not so dumb yourself.
I got sartorial splendor, baby. Sartorial splendor. And you're out there with the charter crowd?
I am. I'm here at the National Charter Schools Conference in Albuquerque and looking at some mountains as we speak. Enjoying a nice weekend, again, to see Taos and Santa Fe, New Mexico for the first time, which are really some beautiful places. Did you know that there are pueblos here in New Mexico that have been in existence for over 1,000 years and inhabited that whole time by the Pueblo Indians?
Really?
Well, yeah, I got through my whole education and never knew about any of this.
Really?
Yeah.
Have they thought about setting up a charter school out there?
Actually, charter schools are growing here, which is one of the reasons that the conference is here in New Mexico.
No, I meant in the 1,000-year-old pueblos.
In the pueblos themselves.
Yes.
No, I don't think that they have any charter schools.
Well, that'd be a really neat dimension. That'd be a hook.
Yeah. I think they could locate it right next to the casinos.
Nice. Yeah, talk about an opportunity to learn applicable skills.
Yeah. And that could really help with the whole charter school finance problem.
Yes. Have you been singing little happy songs out there with the charter folks?
Yes, happy songs. We had a mariachi band last night, which is pretty fun. And, yeah, it's a good group. 2,500 people here, 15th anniversary of the charter school movement. So it's good energy.
Wait a minute, 15th anniversary, but charters, how can that be since charters were adopted in 91?
Well, in terms of the first school was in 92.
Exactly. You're on your game, dog.
Yeah, there you go. All right, listeners. Well, if you have something to tell us about New Mexico, charter schools, anything else, shoot us a line at letters@excellence.net. We would love to hear from you. We're going to get going, of course, with the game of Pardon the Gadfly. Then we're going to hear from one of my colleagues giving a field report on the charter school conference. And finally, in-house weirdo Liam will impart some education news of the weird. So let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Jen, kick us off.
All right. Topic one. Rick, do Republican presidential candidates have to offer educational goodies to upper-middle-class parents, or can they follow Bush's lead and focus on poor kids, thereby solidifying their compassionate credentials?
Huh. So it's an either-or, huh? Either-or. Well, I think they could probably do both. I think it's probably advisable to do both, since especially in the Republican primaries, you see a tilt towards middle- and high-income families as opposed to low-income. But most particularly, I think it'd be good if they speak about both, because I think we've spent entirely too much time these last 6 years talking about little or nothing besides trying to raise grade 3 to 8 achievement and proficiency in reading and math. Hugely helpful and hugely constructive, but I think we've taken it as far as we can productively take it. And I think it'd be really useful if we started talking more broadly about schooling and school quality.
You know, the question is, what can Republicans offer to middle-class parents? What can the federal government do to really help their schools improve? It's not clear to me that there's a whole lot that the federal government can do without mucking things up. I could imagine some more tax credits or deductions, let's say for after-school programs or summer programs. You know, parents who are anxious about schools narrowing the curriculum, perhaps you could give those parents some tax breaks to go fill out their child's education after school during the summer.
Yeah, but you can do competitive grants for teacher quality, particularly for AP, for hard-to-staff subjects in high school. I mean, right. There's an opportunity to reward states and districts that want to step out of the box and pay teachers based on qualification, based on performance.
Yeah. All right. That's fair, and I know we're at the bell, but I would say that we've got those programs now. Most are focused on schools serving lots of poor kids, and the question is, you know, is there a federal role in giving that money to affluent schools that have plenty of resources already?
Hey, if it wins a vote, baby.
There it is. Okay, Jen, next up.
All right. 75% of Singapore students are at NAEP's proficient level in math, compared to about a third of U.S. students. Does this mean NAEP is set too high, too low, or just right?
Well, I think this means that NAEP is set just about right, at least in math. I should say that in science, only half of Singapore students are proficient, so the story is a little bit different there. This is from a new study by Gary Phillips. You know, a lot of people have argued for a long time, you know, the Richard Rothsteins of the world, for example, that NAEP is set way too high, that nobody in the world is getting their students anywhere near getting 100% of their students to proficiency. 75% is pretty good, especially if proficient is meant to be something that's a real stretch, that's aspirational, and we don't have a policy of actually expecting 100% of students to get to that proficient level.
Now, on the other hand, of course, Mike, in NCLB, we do explicitly suggest we want 100% of students proficient. Does that change your take or your analysis at all?
Well, no, I think that's exactly the problem. I mean, I think, you know, what's interesting, you look at the new education trust proposals for NCLB, they actually change their tune and say, look, if for states that have high standards, we'll accept if they can get 80% of their students to proficiency, as long as they get basically 100% to some sort of basic level. I think that's the right way to think about it. That would make a lot more sense. It's still very rigorous, still very challenging, but I think it's the right way to think about it instead of today's universal proficiency idea.
Now, should Singapore students be the metric here? Are they a useful metric?
Well, why not? I mean, this is a country. You know, clearly it's a small country, but, you know, I don't think there's any reason to believe that this is a country full of geniuses. This is a country with some sort of diverse population, and they're getting it done.
You sure Singapore's kids don't have us shooting too low?
Well, that's a good question. What do you think about that, Rick?
I don't know. I don't know many Singapore kids. The ones I've always met, I always liked. But
yeah.
I don't think I've actually met any. Maybe I'm imagining that.
Good. All right, Jen, what's left?
All right. A new initiative in New Orleans is offering lots of bonus pay. Top offers are over $17,000 to recruit teachers to the city. Teachers who are already there are mad that they don't qualify for the money. Should they be so angry, or is New Orleans just doing what it has to do?
Who's that for?
Rick.
Oh.
That's for Rick.
Okay. I can handle that. You know, there's a limit here. On the one hand, if you're offering bonuses to folks to get them in, you can't afford to give it to everybody you've already got, or else you, by the time you spread the money around, the bonus doesn't amount to much. On the other hand, this is a pay system guaranteed to ensure that most of your workers are disgruntled and annoyed and feel unappreciated. Part of the problem here is the structure of the teacher labor market. Is that, Mike, when somebody comes in, you know, when you offer some hotshot 22-year-old a big bonus to come work at Fordham next year, and Kobe looks up and says, man, I'm underappreciated. He's going to scoot along across town to my shop or to somewhere else, and we're going to treat him right and show him some love. Problem is that, you know, the teacher labor market is so constricted and there's so little flexibility that you don't get this kind of natural working itself out. So, as far as I can see it, the New Orleans folks are in kind of a lose-lose proposition. If they don't get this money, they're not going to staff up the way they need to. If they do give this money, they're guaranteed to have a whole bunch of disgruntled folks on their hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, you know, I do think that it's okay to offer recruitment bonuses that are higher, especially if you're trying to get people to move. And you could say that, look, this is partly for moving expenses. But there should be some kind of retention bonus for people who are getting results in those schools already. And this is, of course, greater than just New Orleans. I mean, there's a lot of people interested in this idea of trying to pay teachers to transfer to needier schools. And they got to think through this issue because not many people are talking about, you know, how are we going to pay the teachers that are already there?
Mm-hmm. No, that's right.
Well, Rick, I feel like we were much too agreeable today.
We're agreeable people, baby. You're out there. You're in a mellow mood. You're with the charter folks.
Yeah.
You're not your usual ornery, pickly self.
Well, that is true. I am usually pretty ornery, but I do like being around charter school people.
They're uplifting people.
They're optimistic. They're mavericks.
They're part of a movement.
Yeah.
They could sing them charter school, you know, ditties.
That's right. And, you know, sometimes in the policy debates, we're all excited about competition and things like that. Mm-hmm. These people aren't about competition.
They love kids.
Yeah, they love kids.
They want to make a difference. In fact, one of my favorite songs is a charter school ditty that goes, I want to make a difference for just one child. I want to make a young boy smile. I want to bring enlightenment and knowledge. I want to help that youngster go to college.
Wow, Rick. Rick Kesh, that was very impressive.
Why, thank you.
Liam, don't you agree? Wasn't that pretty impressive?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how sincere Liam is around about that compliment there, but.
All right. Well, speaking of charter school conference, let's hear a field report from one of my colleagues.
Hi, this is Kobe. I'm filling in for Mike today. He's out in New Mexico. And we have with us today Checker. Again, actually, I think this is Checker's second time in 3 weeks. It's nice to have you here again, Checker.
Thank you very much. Well, the listenership may get tired of listening to me, but it's nice to have the opportunity. Yeah, a lot of the Fordham team is in Albuquerque at the National Charter Schools Conference, sponsored by the National Alliance of Public Charter Schools, which is a pretty good group and which tries to be the voice of charter schools, of responsible charter schools around the country. There are about 2,500 people here from all over the place. Many of them run schools. Some of them are authorizers. Some of them are funders. Some of them are vendors. Some of them are just plain hangers-on. And there's a lot of energy in the air. There's a lot of energy in the charter movement, which is now 15 years old. The theme of this conference is sort of onward and upward over the next 15 years. I would say the theme of this conference is school quality and how to strengthen it, partly because of the No Child Left Behind emphasis on student achievement and partly because of anxiety in a lot of states. Certainly I've seen this in Ohio about too many mediocre charter schools offering choices, but not really very good choices.
Right. That's been a lot of the problem in Ohio, something you talked about a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Ohio's not alone, unfortunately. Session I'm on later today, for example, is about how sponsors of charter schools, authorizers of charter schools, can do more to foster quality and accountability in the schools that they are responsible for. There's also a little bit of history being made here, or at least being noted here. Yesterday, the Charter School Hall of Fame inducted into it two very distinguished senior figures in the charter movement. Ted Coldery from Minnesota, who is arguably the main theorist of charter schools, going back into the early 1990s, and of course Howard Fuller, who was really the founder and first chairman of the board of the National Alliance, and who was the superintendent in Milwaukee and has been the head of the Black Alliance for Education Options for some years now. A wonderful, wonderful man, and as ardent a charter supporter as you'll find in the world. So they got the Charter School Hall of Fame recognition yesterday.
Checker?
Yes.
This is Liam. Hi. I was just wondering how one gets inducted into the Charter School Hall of Fame. Is there a vote?
It's a secret ballot. It's like Skull and Bones.
Oh, okay.
The honest truth is, I don't know how they got on the list, but they surely deserve it.
Okay. I didn't know if there was a vote, if you voted, or if there was...
I didn't vote. I just observed.
Associated Press,
but
maybe.
I'm very pleased with the outcome.
Is your hotel, does it incorporate any Adobe into its design? Mike was telling us about how there's these pueblos out there that are thousands of years old.
Downtown Albuquerque is not the world's most charming place. It might be third or fourth. Mm. It does not look much like New Mexico. New Mexico, I think, is a wonderful place, full of adobe as well as wide open spaces, deserts, mountains, and, of course, these historic pueblos. But I have to say that walking around downtown Albuquerque is not a turn-on.
All right, well, on that note, we'll leave you to the rest of the conference, and good luck with your session.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Always a pleasure.
All right, what do you think, Rick?
Not bad, not bad. Not as tuneful as my favorite charter field reports, but nonetheless, shared a little bit of the feel of that community.
Absolutely. Okay, well, it is time for everyone's favorite education news of the weird with our specially weird correspondent, Liam Julian. Liam, what's weird this week?
Well, Mike, at a recent meeting of the Detroit School Board, one person who was in attendance there, Miss Hitchcock, was so upset by board members' votes to close 34 Detroit schools that she hurled red grapes at them.
As she was being arrested, Hitchcock was asked what she had thrown at school board VP Joyce Hayes Giles. She responded, quote, "Grapes! I hit her right there," and pointed to her forehead. Hayes Giles told police she was hit in the stomach, saying of the projectile, quote, "It was hard. It startled me because, quite frankly, I didn't know what it was," unquote. It remains unclear whether Hayes Giles had ever before seen a grape. School board president Jimmy Womack called Hitchcock, quote, "a social terrorist," unquote. The grape thrower is currently out of jail, having posted a $100 bond. Rick, you like fruit?
Do you think there was some symbolism in the hurling of the grape, or was that just all she could get her hands on, or all she could get past school board security?
They're in good shape to throw.
They are, but I mean, if you're going to try to hurt somebody, a tangerine is much more effective. And it fits. Problem with like oranges and apples is like we learned this in college when we used to throw them at waterfowl in the pond is, you know, it's especially if you have little hands like I do, you don't get much more control than with, you know, a large projectile. Whereas with something like a tangerine or one of those arangelos, whatever they're called, you can get much improved control.
Rick, you sound like a social terrorist yourself.
I'm just, you know, a plum's good like that too.
Mm-hmm. You know, back at Michigan football games, we used to throw marshmallows at each other.
Really?
Which was fun in September. But by November, when it was really cold out and those marshmallows would freeze, it was a serious danger. You can poke your eye out.
Used to throw them at who? What are you talking about? What? In the audience and
in the
stands?
Yeah, in the student section when we were bored and, you know, there'd be marshmallow fights. But I would say that if anybody from the other team, you know, let's say it was the Ohio State game and somebody had the gall to sit in the Michigan section in Ohio State garb, we would definitely pelt them with marshmallows.
I got to say, it's amazing anybody would ever call University of Michigan soft. You have marshmallow fights after all. Dangerous marshmallow fights.
Hard marshmallows.
Hard marshmallows. That's
they're like ice.
that's I'm not even going to touch that. You know what would be good though? If you go to like Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory, is that what it's called? Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory. They've got like the chocolate covered marshmallows. Now you freeze those bad boys up, and that dark chocolate can get heavy on you. Mm-hmm. You could probably sink a small rowboat.
I think that's right. Thank you. I hope you keep following this story. We need to know what happens mm-hmm. to this woman if she ends up going to jail or not.
Mm-hmm. I think Liam's on top of it.
Yeah.
I'm very impressed.
Oh, good. Good. Well, that is all the time we have for this week. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to read the original Education Gadfly at edexcellence.net. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.